door. Casey considered calling her, but it was right around her bedtime, and she didn't want to interrupt if Jim was putting her to sleep. She also didn't want Jim to think she was checking up on him. That was a sore point between them. He always felt she was checking. Casey went into the bathroom and turned on the shower. She heard the phone ring and went back into the kitchen to answer it. It was probably Jim. She picked up the receiver. "Hello, Jim?"
"Don't be stupid, bitch," a voice said. "You want trouble? You'll get it. Accidents happen. We're watching you right now." Click.
She stood in the kitchen, holding the phone in her hand. Casey had always thought of herself as level-headed, but her heart was pounding. She forced herself to take a deep breath as she hung up the receiver. She knew these calls happened sometimes. She'd heard of other vice presidents getting threatening calls at night. But it had never happened to her, and she was surprised at how frightened she felt. She took another deep breath, tried to shrug it off. She picked up her yogurt, stared at it, put it down. She was suddenly aware that she was alone in a house with all the blinds open. She went around the living room, closing the blinds. When she came to the front window, she looked out at the street. In the light of the overhead street lamps, she saw a blue sedan parked a few yards up from her house. There were two men inside. She could see their faces clearly through the windshield. The men stared at her as she stood at the window. Shit. She went to the front door, bolted it, locked the security chain. She set the burglar alarm, her fingers trembling and clumsy as she punched in the code. Then she flicked off the living room lights, pressed her body to the wall, and peered out the window. The men were still in the car. They were talking now. As she watched, one of them pointed toward her house. She went back to the kitchen, fumbled in her purse, found her pepper spray. She clicked off the safety. With her other hand, she grabbed the phone and pulled it on the long cord back to the dining room. Still watching the men, she called the police.
"Glendale Police."
She gave her name and address. "There are men parked outside my house. They've been here since this morning. I've just gotten a threatening call."
"Okay, ma'am. Is anybody in the house with you now?"
"No, I'm alone."
"Okay, ma'am. Lock your door and set the alarm if you have one. A car is on the way."
"Hurry," she said.
On the street, the men were getting out of the car and walking toward her house.
They were dressed casually in polo shirts and slacks, but they looked grim and tough. As they came forward, they split up, one walking onto the lawn, the other heading toward the back of the house. Casey felt her heart thump in her chest. Had she locked the back door? Gripping the pepper spray, she moved back to the kitchen, turning off the light there, then past the bedroom to the back door. Looking through the window in the door, she saw one of the men standing in the back alley. He was looking around cautiously. Then his gaze turned toward the back door. She crouched down, slipped the chain across the door. She heard the sound of soft footsteps coming closer to the house. She looked up at the wall just above her head. There was a keypad for the alarm and a big red button marked Emergency. If she hit that button, a screeching alarm would sound. Would that scare him away? She wasn't sure. Where were the damned police, anyway? How long it had been? She realized she could not hear the footsteps any more. Cautiously, she raised her head until she could peer out the bottom corner of the window. The man was walking down the alley away from her now. Then he turned, circling the house, heading back to the street. Staying low, Casey ran back to the front of the bungalow, to the dining room. The first man was no longer on her lawn. She felt panic. Where was he? The second man appeared on the lawn, squinted at the front of her house, then headed back toward the car. She saw the first man was already in the car, sitting in the passenger seat. The second man opened the door and got in behind the wheel. Moments later, a black and white squad car pulled up behind the blue sedan. The men in the car seemed surprised, but they didn't do anything. The squad car turned on its spotlight, and one officer got out, moving cautiously forward. He talked to the men in the sedan for a moment. Then the two men got out. They all walked up the steps to her front door, the policeman and the two men from the car. She heard the doorbell ring and answered it. A young police officer said, "Ma'am, is your name Singleton?" "Yes," she said.
"You work for Norton Aircraft?"
"Yes, I do." These gentlemen are Norton security. They say they're guarding you.
Casey said, what?
Would you like to see their credentials?
Yes, she said, I would.
The policeman shone a flashlight while the two men each held out their wallets for her. She recognized credentials for Norton Security Services.
We're sorry, ma'am, one of the guards said. We thought you knew. We've been told to check the house every hour. Is that all right with you?
Yes, she said. It's fine.
The policeman said to her, is there anything else?
She felt embarrassed. She mumbled thanks and went back inside.
Make sure you lock that door, ma'am, the guard said politely.
Yeah, I got him parked in front of my house, too, Kenny Byrne said.
Scared the hell out of Mary. What's going on anyway? Labor negotiations aren't for another 2 years.
I'll call Martyr, she said.
Everybody gets guards, Martyr said on the phone. The union threatens one of our team, we detail guards. Don't worry about it.
Did you talk to Brule? She said.
Yeah, I straightened him out. But it'll take a while for the word to filter down to the rank and file. Until it does, everybody gets guards.
Okay, she said.
This is a precaution, Martyr said. Nothing more.
Okay, she said.
Get some sleep,
Martyr said, and hung up.
Tuesday. Glendale, 5:45 a.m. She awoke uneasily before the alarm went off. She pulled on a bathrobe, walked to the kitchen to turn on the coffee, and looked out the front window. The blue sedan was still parked on the street, the men inside. She considered taking her 5-mile run. She needed that exercise to start her day, but decided against it. She knew she shouldn't feel intimidated, but there was no point in taking chances. She poured a cup of coffee, sat in the living room. Everything looked different to her today. Yesterday, her little bungalow felt cozy. Today, it felt small, defenseless, isolated. She was glad Allison was spending the week with Jim. Casey had lived through periods of labor tension in the past. She knew that the threats usually came to nothing, but it was wise to be cautious. One of the first lessons Casey had learned at Norton was that the factory floor was a very tough world, tougher even than the assembly line at Ford. Norton was one of the few remaining places where an unskilled high school graduate could earn $80,000 a year with overtime. Jobs like that were scarce and getting scarcer. The competition to get those jobs and to keep them was fierce. If the union thought the China sale was going to cost jobs, they could very well act ruthlessly to stop it. She sat with the coffee cup on her lap and realized she dreaded going to the factory. But of course she had to go. Casey pushed the cup away and went into the bedroom to dress. When she came outside and got into her Mustang, she saw a second sedan pull up behind the first. As she drove down the street, the first car pulled out, following her. So Martyr had ordered 2 sets of guards, one to watch her house and one to follow her. Things must be worse than she thought. She drove into the plant with an uncharacteristic feeling of unease. First shift had already started. The parking lots were full, acres and acres of cars. The blue sedan stayed right behind her as Casey pulled up to the security guard at gate 7. The guard waved her through, and by some unseen signal allowed the blue sedan to follow directly without putting the barrier down. The sedan stayed behind her until she parked at her spot in administration. She got out of the car. One of the guards leaned out the window.
Have a nice day, ma'am, he said.
Thanks, I will.
The guard waved. The sedan sped off. Casey looked around at the huge gray buildings. Building 64 to the south. Building 57 to the east, where the twin jet was built. Building 121, the paint shed. The maintenance hangars in a row off to the west, lit by the sun rising over the San Fernando Mountains. It was a familiar landscape. She'd spent 5 years here, but today she was uncomfortably aware of the vast dimensions, the emptiness of the place in early morning. She saw 2 secretaries walking into the administration building, no one else. She felt alone. She shrugged her shoulders, shaking off her fears. She was being silly, she told herself. It was time to go to work. Norton Aircraft, 6:34 a.m.
Rob Wong, the young programmer at Norton Digital Information Systems, turned away from the video monitors and said,
"Sorry, Casey. We got the flight recorder data, but there's a problem."
She sighed. "Don't tell me."
"Yeah, there is."
She was not really surprised to hear it. Flight data recorders rarely performed correctly. In the press, these failures were explained as the consequence of crash impacts. After an airplane hit the ground at 500 miles an hour, it seemed reasonable to think that a tape deck might not be working. But within the aerospace industry, the perception was different. Everyone knew flight data recorders failed at a very high rate, even when the aircraft didn't crash. The reason was that the FAA did not require that they be checked before every flight. In practice, they were usually function-checked about once a year. The consequence was predictable. The flight recorders rarely work. Everybody knew about the problem, the FAA, the NTSB, the airlines, and the manufacturers. Norton had conducted a study a few years back, a random check of DFDRs in active service. Casey had been on that study committee. They'd found that only one recorder in six worked properly. Why the FAA would mandate the installation of FDRs without also requiring that they be in working order before each flight was a frequent subject of late-night discussion in aerospace bars from Seattle to Long Beach. The cynical view was that malfunctioning FDRs were in everybody's interest. In a nation besieged by rabid lawyers and a sensational press, the industry saw little advantage to providing an objective, reliable record of what had gone wrong.
"We're doing the best we can, Casey," Rob Wong said. "But the flight recorder data is anomalous."
"Meaning what?"
"It looks like the number 3 bus blew out about 20 hours before the incident, so the frame syncs are out on the subsequent data."
"The frame syncs?"
"Yeah. See, the FDR records all the parameters in rotation in data blocks called frames. You get a reading for, say, airspeed, and then you get another reading 4 blocks later. Airspeed readings should be continuous across the frames. If they're not, the frames are out of sync, and we can't build the flight. I'll show you."
He turned to the screen, pressing keys.
"Normally, we can take the DFDR and generate the airplane in tri-axis. There's the plane ready to go."
A wireframe image of the Norton N-22 widebody appeared on the screen. As she watched, the wireframe filled in until it took on the appearance of an actual aircraft in flight.
"Okay, now we feed it your flight recorder data."
The airplane seemed to ripple. It vanished from the screen, then reappeared. It vanished again, and when it reappeared, the left wing was separated from the fuselage. The wing twisted 90 degrees while the rest of the airplane rolled to the right. Then the tail vanished. The entire plane vanished, reappeared again, vanished again.
"See, the mainframe's trying to draw the aircraft," Rob said, "but it keeps hitting discontinuities. The wing data doesn't fit the fuse data, which doesn't fit the tail data, so it breaks up."
"What do we do?" she said.
"Resync the frames, but that'll take time."
"How long? Martyrs on my back."
"It could be a while, Casey. The data's pretty bad. What about the QAR?
"There isn't one."
"Well, if you're really stuck, I'd take this data to Flight Sims. They have some sophisticated programs there. They might be able to fill in the blanks faster and tell you what happened."
"But Rob..."
"No promises, Casey," he said. "Not with this data. Sorry."
Building 64, 6:51 a.m. Casey met Richmond outside Building 64. They walked together in the early morning light toward the building. Richmond yawned.
"You were in marketing, weren't you?"
"That's right," Richmond said. "We sure didn't keep these hours."
"What did you do there?"
"Not much," he said. "Edgerton had the whole department doing a full-court press on the China deal. Very hush-hush, no outsiders allowed. They threw me a little legal work on the Iberian negotiation."
"Any travel?"
Richmond smirked.
"Just personal."
"How's that?" she said.
Well, since marketing had nothing for me to do, I went skiing.
Sounds like fun. Where'd you go? Casey said.
You ski? Richmond said.
Personally, I think the best skiing outside of Gstaad is Sun Valley. That's my favorite. You know, if you have to ski in the States.
She realized he hadn't answered her question. By then, they had walked through the side door into Building 64. Casey noticed the workers were openly hostile, the atmosphere distinctly chilly.
What's this? Richmond said. We got rabies today?
Union thinks we're selling them out on China.
Selling them out? How?
They think management's shipping the wing to Shanghai. I asked Martyr. He says no.
A klaxon sounded, echoing through the building. Directly ahead, the big yellow overhead crane cranked to life, and Casey saw the first of the huge crates containing the wing tooling rise 5 feet up into the air on thick cables. The crate was constructed of reinforced plywood. It was as broad as a house and probably weighed 5 tons. A dozen workers walked alongside the crate like pallbearers, hands up, steadying the load as it moved toward one of the side doors and a waiting flatbed truck.
If Martyr said no, Richmond said, then what's the problem?
They don't believe him.
Really? Why not?
Casey glanced to her left where other tools were being crated for shipment. The huge blue tools were first packed in foam, then braced internally and then crated. All that padding and bracing was essential, she knew, because even though the tools were 20 feet in length, they were calibrated to thousandths of an inch. Transporting them was an art in itself. She looked back at the crate moving on the hoist. All the men standing beneath it were gone. The crate was still moving laterally 10 yards from where they stood.
Uh-oh, she said.
What?
Richmond said.
She was already pushing him.
Go,
she said, shoving Richmond to the right, toward the shelter of the scaffolding that stood beneath the partially assembled fuselage.
Richmond resisted. He didn't seem to understand that.
Run, she shouted. It's going to break loose.
He ran.
Behind her, Casey heard the creak of rending plywood and a metal twang as the first of the hoist cables snapped and the giant crate began to slide from its harness. They had just reached the fuselage scaffolding when she heard another twang and the crate smashed down onto the concrete floor. Slivers of plywood exploded in all directions, whistling through the air. They were followed by a thunderous whomp as the crate toppled over on its side. The sound reverberated through the building.
Jesus Christ, Richmond said, turning to look back at her. What was that?
That, she said, is what we call a job action. Men were running forward, hazy forms in the cloud of lingering dust. There were shouts and calls for help. The medic alarm sounded, ringing through the building. At the opposite side of the building, she saw Doug Daugherty shaking his head mournfully. Richmond looked over his shoulder and pulled a 4-inch splinter of plywood from the back of his jacket.
Jeez, he said.
He took the jacket off, inspected the tear, putting his finger through the hole.
That was a warning, Casey said. And they've also wrecked the tool. Now it'll have to be uncrated and rebuilt. This means weeks of delay.
Floor supervisors in white shirts and ties ran forward into the group around the fallen crate.
What happens now? Richmond said.
They'll take names and kick ass, Casey said. But it won't do any good. There'll be another incident tomorrow. There's no way to stop it.
This was a warning,
Richmond said. He put the jacket back on. To the IRT, he said. A clear signal. Watch your backs, watch your heads. We'll see falling wrenches, all sorts of accidents, whenever we're on the floor. We'll have to be careful. Two workmen broke away from the group around the crate and started walking toward Casey. One man was burly, wearing jeans and a red-checked work shirt. The other was taller and wore a baseball cap. The man in the work shirt held a steel drill press stanchion in his hand, swinging it at his side like a metal club.
Casey, Richmond said.
I see them, she said. She was not going to get rattled by a couple of floor goons. The men walked steadily toward her. Suddenly a supervisor appeared in front of them, holding his clipboard, demanding the men show their badges. The men stopped to talk to the supervisor, glaring at Casey over his head. "We won't have any trouble with them," she said. "An hour from now they'll be gone." She went back to the scaffolding, picked up her briefcase. "Come on," she said to Richmond. "We're late." Building 64, IRT, 7 a.m. Chairs scraped as everyone pulled up to the Formica table.
"Okay," Martyr said, "let's get started. We're having some union activity aimed at stalling this investigation. Don't let it get to you. Keep your eye on the ball. First item, weather data."
The secretary passed sheets around the room. It was a report from the L.A. Traffic Control Center on a form marked Federal Aviation Administration, Report of Aircraft Accident. Casey read, "Weather data. Conditions in accident area at time of accident. JAL-054, a B-747R, was 15 minutes ahead of TPA-545 on the same route and 1,000 feet above. JAL-054 made no report of turbulence. Report just prior to accident. UAL-829, a B-747R reported moderate chop at the FIR 40 North, 165 East at FL-350. This was 120 miles north and 14 minutes ahead of TPA-545. UAL-829 made no other reports of turbulence. First report subsequent to accident. AAL-722 reported continuous light chop at 39 North, 170 East at FL-350. AAL-722 was on the same route, 2,000 feet below, and approximately 29 minutes behind TPA-545. AAL-722 made no report of turbulence.
We still have satellite data coming, but I think the evidence speaks for itself. The three aircraft nearest in time and location to Trans-Pacific report no weather except light chop. I'm ruling out turbulence as a cause of this accident.
There were nods around the table. No one disagreed.
Anything else for the record?
Yes, Casey said. Passenger and crew interviews agree the seatbelt sign was never illuminated.
Okay, then we're done with the weather. Whatever happened to that plane wasn't turbulence. Flight recorder?
Data's anomalous, Casey said. They're working on it.
Visual inspection of the plane?
The interior was severely damaged, Doherty said, but the exterior was fine. Cherry.
Leading edge?
No problem we could see. We'll have the aircraft here today. I'll look at the drive tracks and latches, but so far, nothing.
You tested the control surfaces?
No problem.
Instrumentation? Bravo, Zulu. How many times you test them?
After we heard the passenger story from Casey, we did 10 extensions. Trying to get a disagree, but everything's normal.
What story? Casey, you got something from the interviews?
Yes, she said. One passenger gave a report of a slight rumbling coming from the wing, lasting 10 to 12 seconds.
Shit,
Martyr said.
Followed by a slight nose up, then a dive.
God damn it!
And then a series of violent pitch excursions.
Martyr glared at her.
Are you telling me it's the slats again? Have we still got a slats problem on this aircraft?
I don't know, Casey said. One of the flight attendants reported that the captain said he had an uncommanded slats deployment and that he'd had problems with the autopilot.
Christ! And problems with the autopilot?
Screw him, Byrne said.
This captain changes his story every 5 minutes, tells traffic control he's got turbulence, tells the stewardess he's got slats. Right now I bet he's telling the carrier a whole different story. Fact is, we don't know what happened in that cockpit.
It's obviously slats, Martyr said.
No, it's not, Byrne said. The passenger Casey talked to said the rumbling sound came from the wing of the engines, isn't that right?
Right, Casey said.
But when she looked at the wing, she didn't see the slats extend, which she would have seen if it happened.
Also true, Casey said.
But she couldn't have seen the engines because they'd be hidden by the wing. It's possible the thrust reversers deployed,
Fern said. At cruise speed, that'd produce a definite rumble, followed by a sudden drop in airspeed, probably a roll. The pilot shits, tries to compensate, overreacts. Bingo.
Any confirmation thrusters deployed, Martyr said. Damage to the sleeves, unusual rub strips.
We looked yesterday, Burns said, and we didn't find anything. We'll do ultrasound and x-rays today. If there's something there, we'll find it.
Okay, Martyr said.
So, we're looking at slats and thrusters, and we need more data. What about the NVMs? Ron? The faults suggest anything?
They turned to Ron Smith. Under their gaze, Ron hunched lower in his seat, as if trying to pull his head between his shoulders. He cleared his throat.
Well, Martyr said, yeah, John, we have a slats disagree on the FDAU printout.
So the slats did deploy.
Well, actually,
and the plane started porpoising, beat the hell out of the passengers, and killed three. Is that what you're telling me?
No one spoke.
Jesus, Martyr said. What is the matter with you people? This problem was supposed to be fixed 4 years ago. Now you're telling me it wasn't?
The group fell silent and stared at the table, embarrassed and intimidated by Martyr's rage.
God damn it, Martyr said.
John, let's not get carried away. It was Trung, the avionics head, speaking quietly. We're overlooking a very important factor, the autopilot.
There was a long silence. Martyr glared at him. What about it? He snapped.
Even if the slats extend in cruise flight, Trung said, the autopilot will maintain perfect stability. It's programmed to compensate for errors like that. The slats extend, the AP adjusts, the captain sees the warning and retracts them, meanwhile the plane continues, no problem.
Maybe he went out of autopilot.
He must have, but why?
Maybe your autopilot's screwed up, Martyr said. Maybe you got a bug in your code.
Trung looked skeptical.
It's happened, Martyr said. There was an autopilot problem on that U.S. air flight in Charlotte last year, put the plane into an uncommanded roll.
Yes, Trung said, but that wasn't caused by a bug in the code. Maintenance pulled the A flight control computer to repair it, and when they reinstalled it, they didn't push it in the shelf far enough to fully engage the connector pins. The thing kept making intermittent electrical connection, that's all.
But on Flight 545, the stewardess said the captain had to fight the autopilot for control.
And I'd expect that, Trung said.
Once the aircraft exceeds flight params, the autopilot actively attempts to take over. It sees erratic behavior and assumes nobody is flying the plane.
Did that show up on the fault records?
Yes. They indicate the autopilot tried to kick in every 3 seconds. I assumed the captain kept overriding it, insisting on flying the plane himself.
But this is an experienced captain.
Which is why I think Kenny is right, Trung said. We have no idea what took place in that cockpit.
They all turned to Mike Lee, the carrier representative. How about it, Mike? Martyr said. Can we get an interview or not?
Lee sighed philosophically. You know, he said, I've spent a lot of time in meetings like this, and the tendency is always to blame the guy who's not there. It's human nature. I've already explained to you why the flight crew left the country. Your own records confirms the captain is a first-rate pilot. It's possible he made an error, but given the history of the problems with this aircraft, slats problems, I'd look first at the aircraft, and I'd look hard.
We will, Martyr said. Of course we will, but...
Because it's to no one's advantage, Lee said, to get into a pissing match. You're focused on your pending deal with Beijing.
Fine, I understand.
But I would remind you that Trans-Pacific is also a valued customer of this company. We've bought 10 planes to date, and we have 12 more on order. We're expanding our routes, and we are negotiating a feeder deal with a domestic carrier. We don't need any bad press at the moment, not for the planes we've bought from you, and certainly not for our pilots.
I hope I'm being clear.
Clear as a fucking bell, Martyr said. I couldn't have said it better myself. Guys, you have your marching orders. Get on with it. I want answers.
Building 202, FSIM. 7:59 a.m.
Flight 545, Felix Wallerstein said.
It's very disturbing. Very disturbing indeed.
Wallerstein was a silver-haired, courtly man from Munich. He ran the Norton flight simulator and pilot training program with Germanic efficiency.
Casey said, Why do you say 545 is disturbing?
Because, he shrugged. How could it happen? It does not seem possible.
They walked through the large main room of Building 202. The two flight simulators, one for each model in service, stood above them. They appeared to be truncated nose sections of the aircraft, held up by a spidery array of hydraulic lifts.
Did you get the data from the flight recorder? Rob said you might be able to read it.
I tried, he said, with no success. I hesitate to say it is useless, but... What about the QAR?
No QAR, Felix.
Ah,
Wallerstein sighed.
They came to the command console, a series of video screens and keyboards to one side of the building. Here the instructors sat while they monitored the pilots being trained in the simulator. Two of the simulators were being used as they watched.
Casey said, Felix, we're concerned the slats extended in cruise flight, or possibly the thrust reversers.
So, he said, why should that matter?
We've had problems with slats before.
Yes, but that is long since fixed, Casey. And slats cannot explain such a terrible accident.
Where people are killed?
No. No, not from slats, Casey.
You're sure?
Absolutely, I will show you.
He turned to one of the instructors at the console.
Who's flying the N-22 now?
Ingram, first officer from Northwest.
Any good?
Average. He's got about 30 hours.
On the closed-circuit video screen, Casey saw a man in his mid-30s, sitting in the pilot's seat of the simulator.
And where is he now? Felix said. Let's see, the instructor said, consulting his panels. He's over the Mid-Atlantic, FL 33.8 Mach. Good, Felix said. So, he's at 33,000 feet, 8/10 the speed of sound. He's been there a while and everything seems to be fine. He's relaxed, maybe a little lazy. Yes, sir. Good. Deploy Mr. Ingram's slats.
The instructor reached over and pushed a button. Felix turned to Casey.
Watch carefully, please.
On the video screen, the pilot remained casual, unconcerned. But a few seconds later, he leaned forward, suddenly alert, frowning at his controls.
Felix pointed to the instructor's console and the array of screens. Here you can see what he is seeing. On his flight management display, the slats indicator is flashing, and he's noticed it. Meanwhile, you see the plane gives a slight nose up. The hydraulics whirred, and the big cone of the simulator tilted upward a few degrees. Mr. Ingram now checks his slats lever as he should. He finds it's up and locked, which is puzzling since it means he has an uncommanded slats deploy. The simulator remained tilted up. So Mr. Ingram is thinking it over. He has plenty of time to decide what to do. The aircraft is quite stable on autopilot. Let's see what he decides.
Ah, he decides to play with his controls. He pulls the slats lever down, then up. He's trying to clear the warning, but that doesn't change anything. So, he now realizes he has a system problem on his aircraft, but he remains calm. He's still thinking, what will he do? He changes the autopilot params. He descends to a lower altitude and reduces his airspeed. Absolutely correct. He is still in the nose-up attitude, but now at far more favorable conditions of altitude and speed. He decides to try the slats lever again.
The instructor said,
Should I let him off the hook?
Why not? Felix said. I believe we've made the point.
The instructor punched a button. The simulator tilted back to level.
And so, Felix said, Mr. Ingram is restored to normal flight. He makes a note of his problem for the maintenance crews, and he continues on his way to London.
But he stayed in the autopilot, Casey said. What if he went out of it?
Why should he do that?
He's in cruise flight. The autopilot has been operating the plane for at least a half an hour.
But suppose he did?
Felix shrugged, turned to the instructor.
Fail his autopilot.
Yes, sir.
An audible alarm sounded. On the video screen, they saw the pilot look at the controls and take the stick in his hands. The audible alarm ended. The cockpit became silent. The pilot continued to hold the stick.
Is he flying the plane now? Felix asked.
Yes, sir, the instructor said. He's at FL 290.71 Mach with autopilot disabled.
Okay, Felix said.
Deploy his slats.
The instructor pushed a button. On the systems monitor in the training console, the slats warning flashed, first amber, then white. Casey looked at the adjacent video screen and saw the pilot leaning forward. He had noticed the warning in the cockpit.
Now, Felix said. Once again, we see the aircraft nose up, but this time Mr. Ingram must control it himself. So he brings the stick back, very slightly, very delicately. Good. And now he is stable.
He turned to Casey.
You see? He shrugged. It is very puzzling. Whatever happened to that trans-Pacific flight, it cannot be the slats.
And not thrusters, either. In either case, the autopilot will compensate and maintain control.
I tell you, Casey, what happened to that aircraft is a mystery.
Back in the sunlight, Felix walked over to his Jeep with a surfboard on top.
I have a new Henley board, he said. Like to see it?
Felix, she said, Martyr is starting to scream.
So let him. He enjoys it.
What do you think happened to 545?
Well, let us be frank. Flight characteristics of an N-22 are such that if slats deploy at cruise speed and the captain goes out of the autopilot, the aircraft is rather sensitive. You remember, Casey, you did the study on it 3 years ago, right after we made the final fix on the slats?
That's right, she said, thinking back. We put together a special team to review flight stability issues on the N-22. But we concluded there wasn't a control sensitivity problem, Felix.
And you were correct, Felix said. There is no problem.
All modern aircraft maintain flight stability with computers. A jet fighter cannot be flown at all without computers. Fighters are inherently unstable. Commercial transports are less sensitive, but even so, computers shift fuel, adjust attitude, adjust CG, adjust thrust on the engines. Moment to moment, the computers continuously make small changes to stabilize the aircraft.
Yes, Casey said, but the planes can be flown out of autopilot as well.
Absolutely, Felix said. And we train our captains to do that. Because the aircraft is sensitive, when the nose goes up, the captain must very gently bring it back again. If he corrects too strongly, the plane noses over. In that case, he must pull up. But again, very gently, or he is likely to overcorrect. So the plane would climb sharply, then nose down once more. And this is precisely the pattern that occurred on the Trans-Pacific flight.
You're saying it was pilot error?
Ordinarily, I would think so, except the pilot was John Chang.
He's a good pilot.
No, Felix said. John Chang is a superb pilot. I see a lot of pilots here, and some are truly gifted. It's more than quick reflexes and knowledge and experience. It's more than skill. It's a kind of instinct. John Chang is one of the 5 or 6 best captains I've ever trained on this aircraft, Casey.
So whatever happened to Flight 545, it cannot be pilot error. Not with John Chang in the chair.
I'm sorry, but in this case, it has to be a problem with the aircraft, Casey. It has to be that aircraft.
To Hangar 5, 9:15 a.m. As they walked back across the vast parking lot, Casey was lost in thought.
So, Richmond said after a while,
Where are we?
Nowhere. No matter how she put the evidence together, that was the conclusion she came to. They had nothing solid so far. The pilot had said it was turbulence, but it wasn't turbulence. A passenger gave a story consistent with Slat's deployment, but Slat's deployment couldn't explain the terrible damage to the passengers. The stewardess said the captain fought the autopilot, which Trung said only an incompetent captain would do. Felix said the captain was superb. Nowhere. They were nowhere. Beside her, Richmond trudged along, not saying anything. He had been quiet all morning. It was as if the puzzle of Flight 545, so intriguing to him yesterday, had now proven too complex. But Casey was not discouraged. She had come to this point many times before. It was no surprise the early evidence appeared to conflict, because aircraft accidents were rarely caused by a single event or error. The IR teams expected to find event cascades, one thing leading to another, and then another. In the end, the final story would be complex. A system failed, a pilot responded, the aircraft reacted unexpectedly, and the plane got in trouble. Always a cascade. A long chain of small errors and minor mishaps. She heard the whine of a jet. Looking up, she saw a Norton wide-body silhouetted against the sun. As it passed over her, she saw the yellow Trans-Pacific insignia on the tail. It was the ferry flight from LAX. The big jet landed gently, puffed smoke at the wheels, and headed toward Maintenance Hangar 5. Her beeper went off. She unclipped it from her belt. Star, 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 N-22, rotor burst, Miami. TV now, BTOYA. Oh, hell, she said. Let's find a TV.
Why, what's the matter? Richmond said.
We have trouble.
Building 64, IRT, 9:20 a.m. This was the scene just moments ago at Miami International Airport when a Sunstar Airlines jet burst into flames after its left starboard engine exploded without warning, showering the crowded runway with a hail of deadly shrapnel.
Aw, blow me, Kenny Burns shouted.
A half-dozen engineers were crowded around the TV set, blocking Casey's view as she came into the room. Miraculously, none of the 270 passengers on board were injured. The N-22 Norton widebody was revving for takeoff when passengers noticed clouds of black smoke coming from the engine. Seconds later, the plane was rocked by an explosion as the left starboard engine literally blew to pieces and was quickly engulfed in flames. The screen didn't show that. It just showed an N-22 aircraft seen from a distance, with dense black smoke gushing from beneath the wing.
Left starboard engine, Byrne snarled, as opposed to the right starboard engine, you silly twit.
The TV now showed close-ups of passengers milling around the terminal. There were quick cuts. A young boy of 7 or 8 said, "All the people got excited because of the smoke." Then they cut to a teenage girl who shook her head, tossing her hair over her shoulder.